Maine's June primary is drawing near, and today we bring you another in our series of Your Vote 2018 interviews with the candidates vying for their party's nominations in the race for governor and 2nd District congressional seat. In this series, we'll hear from all 14 primary candidates on a range of key issues. We'll also find out why each believes that they're the best choice to represent their party in the general election this fall. If you miss either of our candidate interviews in this hour, you can hear all 14 conversations at mainepublic.org/yourvote. You can also learn more about each of the candidates and see their positions broken down on an easy-to-use issues grid near the top of our Your Vote 2018 page. Today we'll hear from two gubernatorial hopefuls, Republican Mary Mayhew and Democrat Donna Dion. Mary Mayhew was a lobbyist for the Maine Hospital Association for about a decade before joining Governor Paul LePage's administration as a senior health policy advisor. Shortly after that, Mayhew was named Commissioner of the Department of Health and Human Services. She remained in that post until May of last year when she resigned to run for governor. As she told Maine Public Steve Missler, what separates her from her opponents in this primary is her experience.
I am battle-tested with proven results. I've taken on some of the most difficult issues to get our financial house in order and to prioritize the needs of our most vulnerable. I know what to do on day one because I oversaw over a third of the state budget. I'm prepared to take on the rest of it.
What is the biggest challenge facing Maine, and what would you do as governor to respond to that challenge?
Well, the biggest challenge, frankly, is protecting the ground that we've gained. You know, unfortunately, the legislature is often reactive to crises, but here we are today with a financially stable foundation, $200 million in our state's rainy day fund. We need to make sure that we continue down this path to grow Maine's economy. So we've got to do a great job of not allowing people to start throwing money at problems, to spend money again like it's water, and continue to invest in our future by growing our workforce so that we're able to meet the job demands that exist today and in the future.
Polls continue to show that jobs are the biggest concern for voters in the state, and that's no surprise. But what would you do as governor to help grow the economy?
Well, certainly what I know, speaking to employers around the state, many still do not feel valued, appreciated, or respected. They worry about what the next nail in their coffin is going to be out of Augusta. What I know, this isn't complicated. We need to get government out of the way and out of their pockets, whether that's a small business or a large business. Businesses need to be able to reinvest and not have to send more and more money to Augusta. And they need to have predictability. They can't have the rules of the game changing constantly. So that's where you need to stand guard against the constant tax increases or the new regulations. So businesses here in Maine know that this is a good environment to grow and invest in their businesses. And that matters to families who need those jobs.
As you know, Maine voters will be using ranked choice voting in the primary. Assuming that you will rank yourself as the top choice, how will you be ranking the rest of the candidates?
I won't. Ranked choice voting is a scam. It's going to undermine the integrity of our election process. It's going to create uncertainty. You know, the wonderful thing about our republic democracy is that we have smooth transitions within our governments. And in this scenario, we won't know on election night who the nominee is going to be. And frankly, if it goes to court, we may not know for weeks. That is a tragedy when there was nothing broken with the system that required this ridiculous law.
Nationally, Maine ranks relatively low in its rate of gun violence, but nearly half of domestic homicides in the state involve guns. Should Maine's gun laws be changed? And if so, how?
No. Our gun laws should not be changed. One of the challenges we often face, and again, it goes back to legislators often reacting to a crisis as opposed to how well are we enforcing existing laws, not just laws pertaining to access to guns. How well are we managing protection from abuse orders? There are a whole host of issues that pertain to protecting individuals from domestic violence, laws that are on the books today that we need to make sure are being enforced. And that certainly would be my focus. I mean, think about it, Stephen, you know this. Over 2,000 bills routinely being introduced into the state of Maine, into the legislature every year. In what world do we need that many more laws passed in this state? Laws that ultimately take away freedom and liberty from individuals, from law-abiding citizens.
Maine is currently enjoying a really low unemployment rate, but it ranks 44th nationally in median household income. How can you help Mainers earn more money?
Yeah. Again, not a complicated issue. It takes fierce determination and leadership to change Maine's economic future. We just have to look at neighboring New Hampshire. New Hampshire leads the country with its per capita income. This isn't rocket science. You need to have a tax policy that is not constantly raiding the paychecks of hardworking Mainers. We need to get rid of the income tax. When we do that, we are going to see a level of economic activity in this state that is going to generate the jobs and increased per capita income. You know, here's the scenario that truly frustrates me so. You know, the answer for decades has been that Maine is a poor state, always will be a poor state, this defeatist attitude that has led to an unprecedented growth in government. When you grow government and then obviously have to increase the taxes to pay for it, you take away the one thing that matters most to individuals and families in the state, and that's the availability of good opportunities and jobs. Because when you grow government, you absolutely take away the opportunity for businesses to be here, to be successful here, and to invest in Maine.
The flip side of eliminating the income tax is that it might put downward pressure on municipalities to raise revenue via property taxes. New Hampshire does have high property taxes. What do you say to that?
So what I know is that I oversaw the largest state agency in government, and the amount of waste and unnecessary spending, there's still significant opportunity to reduce the size and scope of government. Our population in this state has not changed in over 15, 20 years, and yet the size of Maine government has grown substantially. It just continues to have this growth to justify various programs and the continued funding at the state level. When I went through the Department of Health and Human Services, we were looking at every program, and with one initial fundamental question, why is government even doing this? I know there's an opportunity to eliminate the income tax because we can absolutely cut unnecessary, ineffective spending. And I'm confident that individuals will always spend their money far better than government ever will. And we need to have the same pressure, by the way, at the local level to re-examine spending and what's truly a critical role of government and what has just become protection of status quo.
Maine is one of the more expensive states for electricity customers, although it's the lowest in New England. As governor, how can we lower electricity costs?
This is one of those policy areas where government has tried to pick winners and losers. And government, when it inserts itself into this private sector relationship, really government has nothing to gain or lose, so it distorts the whole economic equation. We need to get government out of that role of picking winners and losers, and certainly out of the role of subsidizing money-losing businesses in the energy arena. I do not want to see ratepayers or taxpayers subsidizing money-losing energy options, right? If they can stand on their own, if solar can stand on its own, if wind can stand on its own, it needs to be a part of the options that people have. But at the end of the day, Steve, I want to make sure that we are driving low-cost energy options. And typically that means analyzing what are the barriers, what are the regulations, what are the taxes, what are some of the environmental policies that have inappropriately stood in the way of opening Maine up to lower cost energy options.
A lot has been made over the years about attracting businesses to the state. Some believe that tax incentives are one way to do that, such as pine tree zones or tax rebate programs. Do you see these programs as effective economic development tools or as corporate welfare? If you don't view it as corporate welfare, is our current suite of programs enough? Do we need to do more?
Well, first of all, I want to go back to my point about current businesses in this state. We certainly want to be able to attract other businesses in the state, but we've got to start by respecting and appreciating the ones that are here today. You know, when I have toured places like Enercon in Gray, Maine, Elmet in Lewiston, Northeast Packaging up in Presque Isle, or McCain Potato, I mean, these are companies that are providing good-paying jobs with benefits, and they don't feel supported today in this state. And much of that pertains to the tax burden and the regulations that are threatening their not only their viability, but their ability to compete nationally, right? Mm-hmm. So when we think about businesses locating to this state, they're going to ask typically a business in Maine and say, you know, is this a business-friendly environment in Maine? What I know about the tax incentives, if we just reduced taxes, if we eliminated the personal income tax, if we reduced the corporate tax, we wouldn't have to be tripping over ourselves looking at various tax incentives or tax credits. In the short term, yes, we need to continue to leverage those tax incentives, the tax credits, in order to help businesses like in the Pine Tree Zones that want to expand here in Maine or want to relocate to Maine. Long term, we need to permanently reduce the tax burden.
A big part of your campaign has been promoting the changes to Maine's welfare system that were done as you were the head of the DHHS and under the Governor LePage's guidance. If elected governor, what additional changes would you propose?
I want to talk about why those welfare reform policies have been so critical. They have been criticized, but there has been such a failure to fully appreciate that at the end of the day, the true compassion that has been core to our efforts, that if you are on any of those welfare programs, it means that you are living in poverty. What the governor said, what I said, is that that's no way of life for anyone, that we wanted to support effective pathways out of poverty by focusing on the potential of individuals and helping them to fulfill their potential, their God-given talent. That's been at the heart of all of our efforts to support individuals and families becoming independent and self-sufficient. As a parent, I have two boys. I believe the same approach as a parent. I want my sons to become strong, independent adults able to support themselves. As governor, I want to make sure that we protect the amazing accomplishments that we've achieved in building that effective pathway out of poverty, incentivizing work. And work is more than just the paycheck, Steve. It's about restoring human dignity, self-worth, self-esteem. We lead the country. You know, we don't get to hear that very often. Maine leads the country in what we have accomplished in disrupting that welfare poverty trap, the dependency trap, and supporting individuals on that pathway. We need to protect it, but we also need to recognize that when employers today are struggling to find employees, we have a crisis in this state and in this country, because for decades we had policies that discouraged work. So it is certainly about helping people fulfill their potential. It's also about making sure that we have a workforce that's ready, willing, and able to work to meet the job demands today and into the future.
As you know, voters overwhelmingly approved expanding Medicaid last year, and I know that you are not happy with that election result. The question I have is, if you are our elected governor and Republicans have majorities in the legislature, would you pursue repeal of that law? And if you don't have the votes and you're governor, how do you handle that law that's on the books now?
Laws get passed all the time and debated for repeal. The initiative process in and of itself needs to be reformed. When you have two sentences on a ballot initiative that read like motherhood and apple pie, and no one is asked, how will you pay for the $400 million price tag? What taxes will you increase? What cuts will you make? There is, it's certainly understood that the legislature has to confront the reality of the Medicaid expansion. As governor, I will absolutely work to repeal it. I led the charge to roll back Medicaid expansion in Maine. You know, that's the thing. Under the Affordable Care Act, this opportunity for states to expand Medicaid and states across the country looking at it and implementing it, Maine already had done it. And we knew what happens when you spend money you don't have. What I saw as commissioner is that we had abandoned, the state had abandoned its core mission of taking care of our elderly and our disabled when it began to add 25-year-old able-bodied adults onto Medicaid. We don't live in a world of unlimited resources. If we did, we wouldn't have to make the tough decisions, but we don't. And so I am going to make sure that the Medicaid program as a safety net program is effectively meeting the needs of an 85-year-old who needs home care, of a 40-year-old with Down syndrome who needs services or supports in his home. That's our priority. And people are continuing to ignore the fact we're not paying assisted living facilities effective reimbursement rates to cover their wages. We're not paying nursing homes effective reimbursement rates, home care, primary care docs. How is it possible that we could add 100,000 new individuals to the Medicaid program while continuing then to ignore all of the current deficiencies in the Medicaid program? It's irrational.
Does the state pay its fair share of local education costs?
Well, let's start with the lack of transparency in educational funding, period. You know, when I took on Medicaid, a $2.6 billion program, that had been a crisis-riddled program, transactionally oriented, claims in the door, payments out the door, and frankly, just to focus on, are we paying timely and accurately? No one was really looking at, well, how much should it cost for this procedure? Or are we seeing good outcomes? Is health being improved? Are people using the system efficiently, or are they having to go to the emergency department, the most expensive point of entry? There are a lot of comparisons between that and education. You know, we just threw $160 million in additional funding to the schools. Was anyone asking to what end? Do we want to see math scores increased? Do we want to see graduation rates increased? What are our objective measures of success? And then what does it cost to deliver on those objective measures of success? We simply don't have transparency around the funding, both at the state and at the local level. I want to know what is an efficient per student spend that can deliver on those high quality educational outcomes. So I'm not going to answer today whether or not we're spending too much or too little. I want to know what's the right spend to help move Maine forward by supporting a high quality educational system for our kids.
Maine is experiencing a teacher shortage. How would you incent more Mainers to consider a career in teaching?
At the end of the day, our focus on evaluating appropriate spending in education needs to be focused on the classroom. No question, right? No gray area here. What happens in the classroom is fundamental to supporting kids getting a high-quality education. So what are the elements in the classroom? Having great teachers who are valued and appreciated, and certainly wages are part of that. So I certainly want to look at how do we remain competitive in the state, and then also how do we remain competitive competing with other states in recruiting teachers or keeping our young adults here to pursue that profession. So we know that wages matter. But here's what I know, having overseen the largest state agency, over 3,600 employees, and we looked at, we did employee satisfaction surveys. So yes, it's about wages, but it's not all about wages, Steve. It's about, are you respected? Is your workplace environment one where you can't wait to get up every morning and go to work? there are problems in our schools, both in terms of the expectations of teachers to be social workers and the degree of societal problems that they are having to confront and deal with every day in the classroom. My sister has been was a middle school teacher for many, many years, is today a middle school principal. And the degree to which she has to call local police for a middle school in Pittsfield, Maine, right? We know we've got significant challenges that are detracting from the opportunity of a teacher to focus on the fundamentals in the classroom. And we also know there's a lot of noise, testing that is dominating their day, test results that they don't get back for 6 months. We've got to streamline and support our teachers so that they can do what they went to school to do, and that's to engage with kids and to support them getting great education.
Mary, you alluded to this earlier when you mentioned that the referendum process is probably not working as intended. So I'm just going to flip that question a little bit and just ask you, how should it be reformed going forward?
Well, here's what we know. The initiative process is not reflecting the voice of Mainers throughout this state. It's incredibly distorted, and it's because it's a low bar to get onto the ballot, and we are a cheap date in Maine. It doesn't take a lot of money, so outside interests, big money from out of state can come in, hire individuals to go out and collect signatures. They can collect the vast majority of the signatures in Portland or Lewiston. It's not reflective of rural Maine, northern Maine, western Maine, eastern Maine. And then we're dealing with initiatives that are undermining the integrity of our legislative process. Look, there's a reason we have that branch of government that is recognized in our Constitution. I want there to be robust legislative debate. I want questions asked, data produced, and informed decisions made. We need to reform the initiative process by raising the bar. We need to require that signatures are collected a certain percentage in every single state Senate district. So they've got to go to Fort Kent, to Calais, to Jackman, to Kittery to make sure that what gets on the ballot is far more reflective geographically of the state of Maine.
There's this working theory that the country is just so polarized that it's best for elected officials to keep their base supporters happy and loyal rather than agree to compromise or build coalitions that could upset their base supporters. Do you believe that that's true? Is that actually happening? And if so, what should be done about it?
No. What I think is that in this day and age of 24/7 media and social media, we have sensationalized issues. We've distorted priorities. We certainly have media where people can just go to listen to what reinforces what they already believe. With 24/7 media, there's not a lot of integrity when you can revise a story that you post at 5 multiple times over the evening. Where is the commitment to accuracy and being objective when reporters can be bloggers and send out personal tweets and then turn around, and we're supposed to believe that the story they wrote in the media is now objective? We've created this problem. Here's what I know. So much of what needs to be done in this state is common sense. And someone who's getting up out of bed every day and going to work, trying to raise their family, be engaged in their community, these are not polarizing issues. They just want to see leadership. I have had people throughout the state, strangers come up to me since the time that I was commissioner to now being a candidate, saying to me, thank you. Thank you for answering the questions. Thank you for being direct. Thank you for standing tall and making the tough decisions. It's putting your finger in the air and making decisions based upon whether or not you are liked at the end of the day that is the problem. People want leadership. And that's what I've done, and that's what I will do as governor.
Candidates for governor often talk about transparency in government, and you've alluded to that a little bit here, too, in terms of education spending and trying to find out how that money is being spent. How important is it for people to know what their government is up to?
Oh, it's critical. And I have so many examples of how we, when I was commissioner, the governor, engaged the public So, Steve, I spoke to Rotary clubs, to Kiwanis clubs, to local chambers, to other organizations in the community, and I spoke to the press to directly communicate with the public so that they have an understanding of what is at stake, what the issue is, but then also how to meaningfully get engaged. You know, one of the examples I give, the first time that we submitted a piece of legislation that said, if you're on cash welfare, you can't use it to bail yourself out of jail. It's for diapers, food, clothing, housing. The first time that bill was introduced, it was killed in committee. When we had the opportunity to communicate with the public, to share information about the integrity of this cash welfare program and what it's supposed to support to help people out of poverty, the next time that we introduced that bill, it received bipartisan support. But that was because the public raised their voices, got engaged, and communicated effectively with their legislators. So we have to have transparency to shape and support voters and the public being involved in the legislative process.
Beyond signing bills into law, how can the governor improve the lives of Mainers?
But let's talk about that, because I think it's really at the heart of what certainly differentiates me from some of the Democratic candidates and, frankly, probably what differentiates me from some of the Republican candidates. I don't think the answer to societal problems is government. You know, government will never be a church. It'll never be a parent, a grandparent, or a Rotary Club. And we should never allow government to try to be any of those things. As governor, I want to make sure that we keep government as limited as possible, so it's not interfering with the opportunities or the prosperity of an individual or a family or a business, that freedom and liberty is what will support individuals and families to thrive, to prosper. It's when government tries to interfere. I mean, I do believe that decades of welfare policies that have discouraged work, that have, frankly, my view, have looked down upon the very people that they were professing to help and to support, have led to the undermining of human dignity, of self-worth, self-esteem. So to help families in this state, I want to make sure that we don't have any more laws passed that steal their freedom, their liberty, or their human dignity.
So Maine has received failing grades for the condition of its infrastructure, and it currently has a backlog of deferred maintenance of roads and bridges. The solution has been, over the years, to band-aid this problem with bonding. Mm. Is that sustainable? And if it's not, how do we address that problem?
It's not sustainable, and it goes at the heart of what's been going on prior to the LePage administration. The distorted priorities, the crisis-oriented budget management. You know, the highway fund is one of the last things considered in the legislative process. It isn't even considered in the total equation of the state budget. Improving our infrastructure is key to our economic success. Businesses need roads and bridges to get their goods transported around the state and out of the state. People need great roads to get to their jobs. And yet today we have a $150 million shortfall in maintaining our roads and bridges. And yes, some of what has occurred over the past years have been Band-Aids that we then pay the price for long term. You know, when I was in the state of Tennessee not too long ago, I was surprised to learn they don't bond for their roads. They have a pay-as-you-go. And they have substantial cash. This is also another state that doesn't have an income tax. It's not their gas tax. That's not significantly higher. So it's about setting priorities and recognizing that as we look at the total state budget, investing in our infrastructure has to be one of the top priorities. And Steve, this comes down to having the backbone and the leadership to make decisions and set priorities. We don't live in a world of unlimited resources, so we've got to be able to prioritize. And what I have seen for far too long people don't want to be they don't want to have to make the tough decisions because they want to be liked at the end of the day. And that is not going to be in the best interests of our state.
What are Maine's three greatest assets, and how would you best leverage those to improve Maine's economy?
It's people, our quality of life, and our fierce determination to succeed. And I will leverage those by getting government out of the way and out of people's pockets, so that the potential of Maine people can truly be fulfilled, that we continue to improve our quality of life in this great state, and that we get away from what had been this defeatist attitude about our state and unleash our fierce determination to be successful and to compete nationally and globally. Because I know, as a parent and so many other families, we want our kids to stay in this state. And for those retirees that have left our state but their hearts are still here, I want them to come home. And I know that when we tackle those three assets and support them, we can have kids that stay here and retirees that come home, and Maine will prosper and families will succeed and thrive.
Mary Mayhew, one of four Republicans vying for a chance at the Blaine House this fall, she spoke with Maine Public's Steve Missler. Up next, Donna Dion served as Biddeford's mayor from 1997 to 2003, as well as chair of the school committee. She also worked for 12 years at Time Warner and as the finance director for two nonprofits, Creative Work Systems and Port Resources. Dion earned a bachelor's degree from the University of Maine at Machias, and as she told Maine Public's Nora Flaherty, her first focus will be on making government work.
Well, I indicated right off the bat, before I even met the other candidates, that my platform was respect. We need to bring respect back into Augusta because we needed to start resolving some of the concerns and issues that we were trying to move forward. And my background is in negotiations. I have 45 years in the financial arena, of which 12 of those were with Time Warner, which I was the first manager in Portland. So as a result, I was required to do a lot of public relations, which turned into negotiations and franchises, and it also turned into me going out and doing checks and balances at other organizations and bringing very volatile individuals who didn't want a stranger in their organization. So I found that I have been very successful in my 45 years in bringing people to the table. And so I saw an opportunity of not just looking at policies, but utilizing that 45 years, and especially my 6 years as mayor of the city of Biddeford, where I not only did policies, but did the overall operations of both the city side and the school side, which is an unusual situation. So I looked at my unique, diverse skill level and said, this is different than just looking at specific issues that people have been handling and looking at a larger picture, the entire operations of the position of governor.
From your perspective, what's the biggest challenge that's facing Maine? And as governor, what would you do to respond to it?
I think we need to bring in more revenue. And that's a big situation, but it encompasses various strategic plans. First of all, there is a possibility of bringing new revenue into the state by just looking at locations or individuals that don't pay any revenue in the state of Maine, for example. I'm working on a project of looking at all of the residential homes that are owned by non-Maine residents who do pay taxes and assist the communities, but they freely use our infrastructure without putting a penny into the income tax levels. So I'm looking at some programs that are being utilized in other states where they receive that extra funds for people who do not reside in the state, who own property in the state, so that we start bringing revenue and taking the burden off of our own people, the Mainers. But at the same time, looking at the educational and collaborating K through 12, but also looking at the vocational end of it in the universities, how we can then match them and have internships in increase the positions that already exist in the state and not necessarily have to lure new businesses, but increase the revenue. I'm a money person. I'm looking at how do we structure what we have? Is it being used effectively? Can we improve it? And how do we change it? And at the same time, how do we successfully implement some of the programs that have been clearly noted about affordable health care, economic development, training, workforce adjustments? My past has allowed me to tamper in all of those arenas, working with the Workforce Investment Act from the federal government for like 7 years, looking at interfacing businesses and the workforce and making sure they have the right skills. So I would look at it as being a revenue situation, which encompasses a lot of other avenues.
Polls fairly consistently show that jobs are the biggest concern for voters in Maine. As governor, what would you do to help grow the economy?
I first would like to look at the businesses that already exist here. They already have rooted in the state of Maine. They have some loyalty. They have an investment. And so how do we take our workforce and provide them, even the new workforce, provide them with proper training, so which enables them as a carrot to tell the businesses, you don't have to invest money to train them. We're going to do the training on the basis that they need in order to assist you in growing your business right here in Maine. And at the same time, working with our students in the colleges for internships and making them have the ability to on-the-job training and not costing the businesses anything, but at the same time providing them with first-quality staff.
As you know, Maine voters will be using ranked choice voting in this primary election. Assuming that you would rank yourself number one, who would be your second or third choice and why?
It's kind of hard to distinguish who would be second because they're all excellent in their area that they are experts in.
Nationally, Maine ranks relatively low in its rate of gun violence, but nearly half of domestic violence homicides in the state involve guns. Should Maine's gun laws be changed, and if so, how?
I think one of the things we first have to acknowledge is, as we're all pointing fingers all over the place and immediately going to the changing of gun laws, I think there needs to be and with my 20 years working in the nonprofit arena with individuals with high challenges, I think it's a multifaceted thing that you have to answer. Should the laws be changed? I think there should be background checks. I mean, we all take driver's license. We have to take a test. And there is multiple things that we do that are not as dangerous as operating a gun, safety. That we have to look at. But at the same time, something I have to acknowledge, you know, my family has utilized hunting guns and so forth. And, you know, we automatically say that, you know, NRA is putting pressure on us not to change anything. I think we have to do a dual action thing of working with them and other sportsmen alliances and that collaborations have to take place. We need to I have an issue with manufacturing more than with gun regulations for some of the guns that are mimic guns that are issued in to the servicemen. It's a multiple thing, and I can't just say that it's regulation, which it is. Background checks, I feel, really do need have to take place and should be nationally, and a database should be created. But we have to acknowledge that some of the safety regulations on how to operate guns and stuff has been created by some of the coalitions as well as the National Rifle Association. So you have to bring them all to the table. It's not one set answer.
Right now, Maine has a low employment rate, but it ranks 44th nationally in median household income. How would you help Maine workers earn more?
Well, first of all, it's deceiving that it's a low unemployment. It's low unemployment by high open positions. There's many businesses that are, need employees. And if we could train our workforces to fill those positions as well as keep our youth in the positions, it would allow them to stop spending excessive amount of money on recruiting and retraining and transitioning these employees and possibly increasing the rate of pay for these individuals. I don't think that a regulation should automatically come about where everyone makes $15 an hour, but I think You know, in a way, I have to acknowledge that Portland, with their referendum in changing minimum wage and initially going to 10, then 10.68, and will be going up again, I think a similar process needs to take place for the entire state. So people have affordable living, but we also have to be sensitive to the businesses and collaboration so that the businesses, small businesses, don't close as a result of putting a mandate that they automatically have to pay all their employees a certain amount. I think there has to be a sliding scale of where a minimum wage would start with someone who's just coming out into the field with no skills to someone who's starting a position that has many years or a specific professional skill. I think we need to increase the wages, but at the same time work with the businesses to increase their ability to bring in more revenue in order to handle that.
Maine's one of the more expensive states for electricity customers, although it's the lowest in New England. As governor, would you try to lower power costs? And if so, how would you do it?
I'm all for energy renewal. We look at the wind in the ocean and what's taking place at the University of Maine and their experimental processes, their pods, and the creation of electricity to diminish the reliance on the power that we fossil fuel and so forth. I think that's an important issue that we have to address. If you could lower the power and the cost or overall for businesses, but especially also homeowners, you're putting more money in their pockets. And this is a dual process, because as you're lowering everything, people have more money in their hands, in their pockets to spend, which helps the economy, and we get more businesses in there. The small businesses are able to expand. We need to look at wind, air, and water. We used to use hydro, the rivers and the dams, and I think there's some possibilities of going back there and creating and diminishing the reliance that we have currently on the power, the high cost of power.
A lot has been made over the years about attracting businesses to Maine. Some people believe that tax incentives are a good way to do that. Do you see these programs as effective economic development tools or as corporate welfare?
No, I think it's an economic development tool. It's not a lifetime for a business to be living on those tools. We do have some of those situations that they were initiated a long time ago. It's one of my goals is to look at who is benefiting from some of the reductions in taxes or specific areas. How long have they been on it? Some of the business needs to transition so we can utilize those tools for new businesses or smaller businesses for them to expand. I don't think it's corporate welfare. An example is we use tax incremental financing in the Biddeford area when I was mayor, and we were able to bring water and sewer on the other side of the turnpike and in turn create what is called Biddeford Crossing and Home Depot, Kohl's, and all of those multiple areas that have grown since then. And that has been a big boost to the Biddeford area, the economy, and employment. And so I see it as a tool if you don't abuse it.
What about Maine's welfare system? Is it too generous? Is it falling short? Is it just right? And if you would change it, how?
I would evaluate it. I think it's being abused. I think, you know, we have so many things on our plate that what used to be a strict monitoring process where individuals used it as a stepping up in order to get a job and be able to provide for their family, it's become a livelihood for some individuals. And so as a result, you get to see those that abuse it, and as a result, lots of people think that's the norm. And I think we need to fine-tune it because we need to still provide the supports that need to happen, but it shouldn't be a lifetime situation. And so I think we need to reinforce the regulations and the oversight.
Voters overwhelmingly approved expanding Medicaid at the polls last year, but the legislature and the governor have been at odds over how to fund it. Do you support Medicaid expansion? And if so, how would you pay for it?
Well, I think there's a couple of things you need to look at. One, as I indicated, I worked for 20 plus years in the nonprofit arena, and we used Medicaid funding. And lots of programs, not all of the programs, but lots of programs also in the process of being funded, they pay, many programs pay a certain percentage, just like the expansion on the Medicaid, which currently we'd pay 6% and the federal government would pay 94%. You have a multitude of those programs that are existing for individuals with challenges, but that amount is 36% is the state and the remaining amount is federal. But what takes place, the federal government has since 2005 established a user fee where part of that money, the 36%, 6% of it goes back to the state into a fund. I would like to know where that Medicaid fund is and how is that utilized, because I think that's a portion, if it's not presently being utilized, which is not publicly being informed, we're not being informed that it is, where that money is, and take an audit of it and make sure that it goes back to the individuals of the state of Maine.
Do you feel that the state pays its fair share of local education costs? And if not, how much more should it cover?
Well, I think it's running around 52%. The legislative bill that was accepted by the state is 55%. But that 55% is an average. And so it's kind of deceiving because you have some locations where they're only receiving 18%. Some people are receiving 32%. What we have to do is look at what the 55% was initially set up to do. I think we need to definitely support. I mean, we've done a lot of things to decrease the flexibility by mutual, revenue sharing and so forth. So the educational area, even though they're paying at 52%, is creating a lot more of a burden because of other funds that are not received in any of the municipalities. So we really do have to evaluate, bring it up to 55%, because that's what it was legally voted on. That's what it was supposed to be. The people, the citizens of Maine have gone back to the polls and indicated they wanted 55%. So if we can afford it. I'm a money person. I always want to make sure, where is it coming from? All of these ideas are great. All of them are necessary in order to move forward. But how do we prioritize them and how do we go forward is a whole other different question. And on education, it has to be educating the individuals with a quality of education. And money and quality is two different things. I mean, we should always have quality through the teachers. So it isn't necessarily related to the money, but we need to have the resources and the technology in order to make that education a quality education also. So yeah, we need to look at what's being done and how we can improve it.
Maine is currently experiencing a teacher shortage. How would you incentivize more Mainers to consider a career in teaching?
I think that brings you right back to the money situation. It has individuals coming out of school have to be able to get a reasonable pay in order to stay within Maine. But I think we need to look at what new teachers are coming out of college with their debt and how can we lure them in providing services to us. And every year that they provide educational teaching to us, that we provide a reduction in their educational debt.
Do you think that Maine's referendum process is working as it was intended? If yes, why? And if no, why not? And how would you change it?
Well, I think it's definitely working the way it's supposed to, but I don't think it was supposed to be working so often. I think as a result of individuals running against walls where issues have been voted on and then vetoed or overridden by the legislature has created more momentum out in the community for open referendums coming. I mean, it's working exactly the way it's supposed to, but I think it's usurping what was supposed to be taking place when we elected individuals to represent us in Augusta. Sometimes the representation is self-serving and not necessarily representing the citizens. So I think if we started doing the things that needed to be done and started talking to each other, the issues would go forward and we wouldn't have so many citizen-initiated referendums.
There's a theory that you hear a lot that the country is so polarized that it's best for elected officials to keep their supporters happy and loyal rather than agreeing to compromise or build coalitions that could alienate those bases. Do you believe that's true? And if so, what should be done about it?
That's why I'm running. There was so much anger, and I knew it was there. I was a citizen out in the community listening to people have arguments about different positions that they held. But I saw it more so in canvassing for our signatures. I mean, I needed 2,000 signatures, and I opted to do anywhere from the 85 to 90% of those signatures personally. I saw firsthand the anger of individuals, the unwillingness to talk to you. We'd have a conversation, and if someone didn't notice what my sign said, they would go on, ask me questions similar to what we're doing right here. And then they say, gee, which party are you? And as I indicated, Democrat, people got violent. I mean, really violent. I mean, their language, their physical presence, their I don't even have to go into it. It was very upsetting. It only motivated me to say, you know, when I had already decided my platform was respect, there is a lack of it. There's a lack of understanding that nothing is black and white, although that's what I've set as my color, my political colors are black and white to make a point that things aren't black and white. You know, Maine has to start talking to each other. And because I was successful in doing that for 45 years is one of the reasons why I'm doing this. People, you know, if I talked to them long enough, I found from January till March that some people, when I first met them, were hostile. At the end, were asking questions. And I think we need to continue doing that. We have to be strong enough to not be defensive and to listen. And that's my big thing. I have to listen and work with what people need and want rather than what I think is best.
Candidates for governor often talk about transparency in government. How important is it for people to know what their government is up to?
Very important. When I became mayor in 1997, I was there for 6 years, and I went there because too many things were hidden. You couldn't see what was being spent. You couldn't see what was being done behind closed doors. And so I launched my campaign and became mayor. And one of the things I made very clear is what you see is what you get. And I was the first mayor who started doing a state of the city. And 6 months into the when I first got in, 3 months in, I wanted to tell them the status. And every 6 months, they would have an update of what's going on and what the needs were. And as often as we had to do specialty things to inform the public what's going on, they need to be brought along as the process is going. You can't say, I know, and I'll just bring you along at the end. That doesn't work. So transparency is extremely important. Why are we hiding it? Because somewhere along the line, there's a new administration coming, and it's going to be boldly in your face. So you might as well pull the people along because you get more support. And actually, sometimes when you have to do something hard, it's not as hard to do when people understand the reason for it.
Beyond signing bills into law, how can the governor improve the lives of Mainers?
Oh, I think the governor's responsibility is the overall operation of the state. And I think we improve our lives by looking at our infrastructure. And other than bills, is looking at the best way to use the funds that we presently have. Make some strong recommendations, not to have a new bill to increase something, but to fine-tune what already exists. The day-to-day stuff is just not signing and vetoing. It is looking at what's going on in transportation and how's the infrastructure handled, what's going on and Department of Health and Human Services, and how are they talking to each other, and how do we improve that, and how do we collaborate with some of the systems that exist that cost us an arm and a leg, and how do we make it better? So it's a horrible way, but a one-stop shop where everyone can get on and look at the system and understand where a person is coming in, a client who is challenged, who needs something. How do we avoid non-communications when they keep pointing fingers? And I know that firsthand. I did 20 more years in nonprofits, and we talked to one department, they would blame another department, and they say, I don't have that records, and wait till they input it. I think the governor is responsible to be working with the commissioners and saying, how do we fine-tune this? How do we get it so everyone is talking to each other, and how do we make it easier for us to move on and maybe save us a lot of money?
Maine has received failing grades for the condition of its infrastructure and currently has a backlog for maintenance of roads and bridges. But bipartisan proposals to deal with the problem have gone nowhere, and the solution has been to ask voters to borrow for transportation bonds. Is that sustainable? And if not, what is your solution?
Well, first of all, any bond, you have to make sure that our revenue and our expenses, that we're not going in a hole and we're not able to maintain the payments in order to pay those bonds back. But I think one of the things I mentioned right at the beginning is how do we increase the revenue in the state of Maine? And I just did an evaluation of one community and found, you know, 800 houses at high value that were owned by people outside the state of Maine who didn't pay a single penny of income tax. So they're not supporting the infrastructure at all, but have the benefit of enjoying it and using it. So I think those kinds of things have to be looked at throughout the state for individuals who have second homes in our state who are from out of state. Any individual who pays any income tax in the state of Maine would be waived from this, but there'd be a user fee for everybody else because they are using our infrastructure, and we need to add more money in there and do capital expenditures so we prioritize what is necessary. Where are the bridges that need to be repaired and have a vision in the next 3 to 5 years? What are we going to look at? What's the revenue we need? If we have to supplement it with bond issues, what is our level of debt to revenue and go forward and establish a plan and not just haphazardly say, gee, we'll just do another bond issue.
In 60 seconds, what are Maine's 3 greatest assets and how would you best leverage those qualities to improve Mainers' economy?
Air, water, and people. I would make sure the environmental protection monitors the volatile compounds that are being emitted from any smokestacks in any of the industries and work with the businesses to fine-tune that to minimize any disruption. Water, because it's also affected by any pollutants that are emitted in the air. Less use of fossil fuel will diminish some of the stuff that's being emitted. All of these areas impact our land, which, you know, farmland. I think there's a big possibility to increase the production of trees and other products and people especially. I mean, we got to keep them healthy, got to keep them happy. They're the biggest resource and assets that we have. Lots of individuals from Maine have a strong ethic and work opportunity. We need to respect them. We need to be listening to their needs. We need to incorporate them and work with the businesses so they listen to the employees who may have their own ideas of our research and development and assist us in growth. So I think those are 3 key areas.
Donna Dion, one of 7 Democrats in this year's gubernatorial primary, who spoke recently with Nora Flaherty. If you missed either of the candidate interviews in this past hour, you can hear all 14 conversations at mainepublic.org/yourvote. You can also learn more about each of the candidates and see their positions broken down on an easy-to-use issues grid near the top of our Your Vote page. I'm Keith Shortall. Thanks for listening.